Learnerd Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnerd Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnerd Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 22, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, a number of lawmakers want an extension for public comment on a proposed rule for livestock and poultry. We'll have these and other stories this half hour. Also, we'll have a report on the upcoming National 4-H Forestry Invitational, as well as a look at agricultural weather and a Farm Bureau commentary. And in the second part of the show, The Farming World, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with John Schull of the American Farmland Trust. It's all on the Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's how prices settled on this Thursday afternoon in Kansas City. September wheat, 611 and three quarters, up 10 and a quarter. December, 629 and a quarter, up 10 and a half. March, 645, up 10 and a quarter. September wheat at the Board of Trade, 596 and a half, up 8 and a quarter. December, 627 and a half, up 8 and three quarters. March, 650, up 9 and a quarter. September corn, 376 and a half, down 3 and a quarter. December, 390 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. March of 2011, 403 and a half, down 2 and 3 quarters. May, 411 and a half, down 3. July, 418 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. August beans, 1016, up 3 quarters. September, 990 and a half, unchanged. November, 979 and a half, up 1. January, 987 and a half, up a half. August soybean meal, $300.20, down 310. August soybean oil, 38.90, up 64. August live cattle, 93.32 and a half, down 17 and a half. August feeders, 114.90, up 25. And those are today's settlements in Chicago and in Kansas City.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Taking a look at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says that the strongest thunderstorms over the next few days will be in the northern Midwest, but net drying is likely in the lower Midwest, despite some scattered showers into the weekend. Temperatures will be very warm in southernmost parts of the region into Saturday, with daily highs in the upper 80s and lower to a few middle 90s. Cooling during the weekend will be more limited than previously suggested. Sunday's highs in the upper 70s and 80s, with most of the Midwest in the 80s. A few lower 90s may linger near and south of the Ohio River. Scattered showers will continue next week, with southernmost areas the driest. Temperatures next week will be back into a seasonably warm mode, with 80s and lower 90s common.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi, Dave.
Did anything in the marketplace today in terms of price action change your opinion about what we were talking about this morning with the potential for perhaps sharply higher prices?
I wouldn't necessarily say that, but as a technician, you always have to acknowledge the fact that the corn close was pretty poor here today. We were up 3-4 cents. We ended up closing down 3 cents. So that would probably have to be viewed as negative, and one would have to see what kind of follow-through we get to the downside on that action here, either in tonight's session or tomorrow. When you look at it on a weekly basis, basically what we are, we're in an inside week. So on a weekly chart, one would say inside week is kind of considered a neutral week, and next week would be more important when we would break outside of the inside week ranges. And there's kind of a rule of thumb there is that once you have an inside day or inside week, and then you go with the trend that it breaks out of that range, either on the upside or downside. So depending upon, you know, what happens tomorrow, how much downside follow through we have, we'll have to kind of wait and see. But some of the real short-term cyclical work that that I watch real carefully had July 22nd here as some high days on this thing clear across the board. So it's not surprising to me to see the market having sold off its highs in here.
So in the corn market, if you're a bull, what will you not want to see happen?
I don't think you would want to see weakness down underneath, let's say, the 50-day moving average, which is sitting in here today around 379. So there's a dime down yet, I think, risk. And that could very well happen and fake everybody out and then turn around and turn back up again. I think as a technician, I mean, you could kind of see a little mini-type head and shoulders top there that might call for, let's say, 10, 20, 25 cents down potential. So there could be a little scary move based upon that. We'll just have to kind of see how that plays out. But, no, I think if you want to maintain your bull position, naturally you don't want to see prices kind of go down below the 50-day moving average. But that is not necessarily a kiss of death either, you know.
Meanwhile, in the wheat market, it was an entirely different story with prices settling higher today, although off the highs of the day.
True, but like I said, we are breaking above last week's high point, and that's where the market, both in corn and soybeans, those markets were not able to punch above last week's high. It does show you that wheat is the leader. What the wheat market, though, does need to kind of solidify this kind of breakout, anyway, of this little consolidation pattern as a market should see some strong follow-through to the upside and maybe post a weekly close above last week's high point of 598. I really think then that would solidify at least the first target to go after here is the 6.25.
And as you said, the soybeans also trying to find a place to punch through on the top side.
And weren't able to do it, at least on the November chart here that I'm looking at. But beans managed more of an unchanged type close, whereas corn actually did close lower. Again, this is somewhat disappointing if you want to argue a bull case. If you're on the bull side of it, you're kind of cheering here, or the bear side, you're kind of cheering. that this thing is maybe going to go ahead and break. But follow through is the key, and we'll kind of see what we get on that tonight and tomorrow.
So you think that in the next day or two, we might have some very important indicators in the technical charts that might give us a hint in the next next week. And
yeah, one thing that nothing's certain in this business, but many times the market goes opposite of the last week of the month of what the dominant trends had been, and you can see. Since that June 30th report, we basically had 3 weeks up. So it's not uncommon to see the market go opposite of that here in the last week of the month. And basically what that is all driven by profit-taking for the month. You got to keep in mind that markets are commission-driven in Chicago. So there is economic incentive to encourage people to take long profits, and then that kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it would not be uncommon to see the market consolidate and maybe even have a setback here during the last week of July. The other thing is that, you know, we're going to start seeing some private estimates, expectations on yields and whatnot, for the August crop report here, probably before next week's out anyway. So we'll see some of that jockeying around. But, yeah, I would say that would be my initial observation. It would not be uncommon to see the market consolidate, maybe even give back some of its advance here on the last week of July.
So then that means potentially the first week of August we'll see a little bit more about what the market is made of.
Yeah, after you have that consolidation or that liquidation, round of profit taking, whatever, then the market, then if this uptrend here that began late June for corn, more so early June for soybeans and wheat would go ahead and kind of continue.
Okay, and anything else before we let you go?
That's about all I have. We'll see what kind of consolidation and pullback we get here. It looks like the markets are in pretty good shape to close out the month of July higher, and that is rare. There's nothing exact in this business, but if you go back in time, you're going to find out 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10 years market closes lower during the month of July, and we are set up here to be one of those 2 out of 10 or 3 out of 10 to close higher, and that is usually a strong indication that you are going counter-seasonal.
Thank you, Dan.
Very well.
That's Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group, and he is in Decatur, Illinois.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
In agricultural news, members of a House Agriculture Subcommittee accused USDA officials of circumventing congressional intent in writing a proposed rule on the marketing of livestock and poultry and urged them to extend a comment period on it. The controversy concerns the implementation of a 2008 Farm Bill provision directing USDA's Grain Inspection, Packers, and Stockyards Administration to write a rule to establish greater fairness in the marketing of livestock and poultry. GPSA published the rule on June 22nd and established a comment period to expire on August 23rd. A bipartisan group of lawmakers on the House Agriculture Committee also sent a letter to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack asking that the extension be granted. A Republican-led effort to permanently repeal the estate tax garnered only 39 votes in the Senate yesterday, as the motion failed during debate on extending jobless benefits. Two Democrats, Blanche Lincoln and Ben Nelson, supported the repeal effort. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said yesterday the U.S. economy faces uncertain prospects and that the central bank was ready to take further steps to bolster growth if needed. Bernanke delivered the Fed's semi-annual report to Congress on monetary policy, and he said that policymakers believe the U.S. economy is still on a path to recovery. Bernanke stopped short of describing what steps the Fed might take if growth were to falter. Analysts say the central bank could resume asset purchases or lower the rate it pays banks to park their excess reserves at the Fed. Meanwhile, a new Federal Reserve study found that U.S. small business owners raided retirement accounts or borrowed from friends and family as banks clamped down on lending. The 19-page report highlighted one of the many culprits behind the slow economic recovery and stubbornly high unemployment. Small businesses' loans outstanding fell to $670 billion in the first quarter of 2010, down from $710 billion in 2008, shortly before the worst phase of the recession. Farming Association DBV today says that German farmers fear wheat yields in the 2010 harvest will be between 10 and 20% lower this year. DBV says that in regions with light soils, wheat did not get enough water to counter the impact of the heat, and grains were sometimes pushed into ripeness before they were fully developed. It did not give a wheat harvest forecast, however. Hershey Company's second quarter net income fell 35% because of charges for restructuring and to write down the value of a joint venture in India, but revenue rose as it sold more chocolate and other candy. The maker of Hershey's Kisses earned $46.7 million, or 20 cents per share, for the 3 months ending July 4th. That's down from net income of $71.3 million, or 31 cents per share, a year earlier. Revenue grew 5% to $1.23 billion. Hershey has been working to cut costs and has pumped more money into advertising. Hershey's ad spending rose 50% in the second quarter. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. The National 4-H Forestry Invitational is set for the last full week of July. Todd Gleason has this look at how the team from Illinois is getting ready for the event.
The tree in the forest provides beauty, comfort to our lives, and it's an important part of the ecosystem and our economy. The world's largest youth group, 4-H, recognizes this and in the United States holds an annual Forestry Invitational. The program, a contest, teaches high schoolers the importance of forestry management and much more, says University of Illinois forestry team coach Dave Shiley.
It prepares these kids to be better students of the environment. They change. They don't look at the forest the same way after they've gone through this contest. And I've kept in touch with a lot of kids over the years that are now 30-somethings. And they still don't remember everything they've learned, but they remember that the forest is more than just the trees out there, and that, you know, management is more than just cutting down a tree.
The team from Illinois has been practicing for the 4-H Forestry Invitational and their trip to West Virginia at the end of July. They're pacing and using compasses and learning all the things it takes to see the forest and the trees, says Illinois team member Haley Miller.
So we just meet like twice a week and we go through. We have flashcards that we have for insects and then for diseases, all the ones that we have to know for the contest. And then we go through the different types of trees. He'll bring in like samples, and like for the conifers, he has pine cones and needles and different things so that we can see like the real thing instead of just a picture.
And then, of course, there's the real thing, like using a Biltmore stick to estimate the size of a tree and or the lumber it might yield, as I found out from Amy Brandt.
What was this thing you were doing with on top of your head and then straight up? What was that?
We were measuring the height of trees with a Biltmore stick.
With a what stick?
Biltmore stick.
With a Biltmore?
It's got to be 25 inches from your eyes, and so that's how long the stick is.
Yeah.
So you hold it to your eye, and then you flip it out. For me, that's my arm length, so I just hold it straight. But
and you can figure out how tall the tree is?
Yeah.
How many logs you can get out of it?
Yeah, you have to walk a distance of a chain, which is 66 feet from the tree, and then you use a Biltmore stick, and you can find, like, how many logs are in the tree.
But we can't go to the top of the tree most of the time because it breaks off or there's a defect, and that affects how many logs you get.
Forestry team members are disciplined, like Megan Gleason. They learn from the coach and each other, a college-level textbook, and yes, in this age, even Facebook, which, if you happen to search the internet for the phrase Forestry Invitational, you'll find too. The contest is in West Virginia, July the 25th to the 29th. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
In this week's Farm Bureau Commentary, Shelby County's Amy Rochkiss says it's time to gather together for the county fair.
County fairs in the United States are descendants of festivals of the Middle Ages with their color, pageantry, excitement, and entertainment of strolling jugglers, acrobats, and musicians. Beyond the entertainment, the purpose of the fair was a merchant's marketplace for silks, furs, and wool. Our well-loved county and state fairs are a tribute to a remarkable institution that has adapted itself to the needs and desires of the public through a century of change. In the 1850s, agriculture was the center of the economy, and the majority of Illinois' population earned their livelihood from raising crops and livestock. A great agricultural exhibit like the Illinois State Fair was a major event. The Illinois State Agricultural Society, the ancestor of the Illinois Department of Agriculture, was deeply concerned that farmers were not advancing satisfactorily in their farming methods. The society decided the best remedy was continuing education, partly through an agricultural fair, to encourage the best in field and garden, crops, livestock, labor-saving implements, and new ideas. The concept of the fair was for farmers to bring the best of the best to show and exhibit. The fair gave farmers the opportunity to share information and see and learn the newest advances in agriculture. Awards were granted to the best oxen, dairy products, fruit, grain, field crops, garden produce, flowers, needlework, butter, baked goods, and artwork, to name just a few categories. The fair has a rich heritage for many people of all ages. For many of us, the county and state fairs are the biggest and best party of the summer. After 100 years, you can still come to see the best of the best in livestock, fruit, grains, field crops, garden produce, flowers, needlework, baked goods, and artwork. County fairs are in full swing. Go take a stroll through your county fair. Go see the best of the best in your county. This is Amy Rochkiss with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkiss's comments are her own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this station. If you would like to make a commentary, contact us at willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. Or phone us at 217-333-7300. On this day in agricultural history in 1822, Gregor Mendel was born. Mendel was an Austrian botanist whose work was the foundation of the science of genetics. Working mainly with garden peas, some 28,000 plants over 7 years, he discovered what was to become known as the laws of heredity. Mendel coined at least two present-day terms in genetics, recessiveness and dominance. In 1915, Sir Sanford Fleming died. He devised the present system of time zones while working for the Canadian Pacific Railway. In 1954, the Miller Pesticide Amendment was passed. It established procedures used by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to determine the maximum allowable pesticides that can remain on raw agricultural products for human consumption. The amendment stated no additive shall be deemed to be safe if it is found to induce cancer when ingested by man or animal, or if it is found after tests which are appropriate for the evaluation of safety of food additives to induce cancer in man or animals. And in 1993, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission approved final rules prohibiting the practice of dual trading by floor brokers unless an exemption is granted by the CFTC. And that's This Day in Agricultural History. Joining us now with a look at agricultural weather is meteorologist John Davis of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, it's an interesting weather pattern because the high-pressure ridge that was advertised a week ago is no longer in it, and then it seems as though temperatures are going to moderate, but not right away.
Well, the ridge of high pressure is still there. It's just a bit further south than what was progged a week ago. Because of that, the real problematic heat across the nation, for the most part, is south of the main producing areas across the Midwest. So where the heat stress is right now is places like the Southeast, the Delta, the Central Plains, places like Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri. And in general, that's where it's going to stay over the next week or 10-day time frame.
And what about rain possibilities?
Well, again, you know, for most of the Midwest, especially the central and northern portion of the belt, you'll continue to have thunderstorms developing across those areas as you get convection, as we call it, firing up on the periphery or northern extent of the ridge of high pressure, the ring of fire, if you will. Further on down south, where the ridge of high pressure will tend to be, then you'll tend to have general dryness, again, in places like the Delta and the Central Plains and the Southern Plains. So the southern U.S. and the central plains tends to be very hot and dry, whereas we here in the Midwest tend to be quite active and also don't tend to have any real problematic heat. And it's all on account of the position of the ridge.
What about further out, 7 to 14 days?
Well, during that time frame, it looks like everything is going to be pretty much status quo. So in other words, the areas that have had heat and dryness problems will continue to have heat and dryness problems. Again, the far, you know, southern U.S. into the central plains. And there's some areas that do produce corn across those regions, Kansas, for example, parts of Nebraska, Missouri. So not the heart of the Corn Belt, but some fringe areas of the Corn Belt. So in general, as we go into the early portion of August, it looks pretty similar to the latter portion of July.
Let's turn our attention to Europe and also to the Soviet Union. Is the area of drought expanding?
Well, it's been expanding for quite some time, and that will continue to take place basically through the end of the month. And in a lot of areas, you're getting to the point because the drought has been so severe across those locales and the damage has been irreversible in nature that it doesn't matter if you change things any in a lot of areas across those locales. We do see some changes the early portion of August as we begin to see some cooler temperatures, getting some better rains in across a lot of those areas. But then the real question is, does it make that much difference? Because a lot of the damage up to this point has been irreversible due to the historic nature of that drought across those areas.
Thanks, John.
My pleasure, David.
That's meteorologist, John Davis of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. And you've been listening to The Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey. Thank you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with John Scholl. He's the president of the American Farmland Trust, based in Washington, D.C. Mr. Scholl, thank you so much for being with us. Why don't you give us first a little background on yourself, where you came from, and then tell us about the American Farmland Trust.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Todd, and thank you for the chance to visit with you today. I think you know I'm an avid listener of what you do. I think your program is fantastic, and I'm honored to be a part of it today. As you know, I'm actually from Central Illinois. I'm still very much involved in the family farming operation just outside of Bloomington, Illinois. And here over the last several years, I've had some terrific opportunities from a career standpoint to get involved in some other things, which has brought me to Washington, D.C., where I now serve as president of the American Farmland Trust. But I still consider Cooksville, Illinois, home, and I try to get there as often as I can. The American Farmland Trust is a national conservation organization that's been in existence for about 30 years. We're just celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. And we're really focused on protecting farmland, promoting sound stewardship of agricultural land, and helping to ensure the economic viability of farms, ranches, and rural communities. We think we serve as an important bridge between a lot of environmental and agricultural interests, and we certainly try to be a proponent of new thinking and aggressive approaches to address environmental and conservation concerns in agriculture, but always with an eye towards the economics of the industry. If farmers can't make money, then clearly we understand that there's a lot more pressure to sell the land to the highest bidder, which is usually a developer, or to take shortcuts or not make the investment in conservation work that we think is very important to the long-term sustainability of agriculture.
Well, let's take that up in just a bit in a unique way. Estate tax is now making its way back through Washington, D.C., and there are many ideas about the estate tax, why it should be in place, what are good things and what are bad things. How does the American Farmland Trust view the estate tax?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the first point I would make is that we look at a lot of different ways in which we try to protect farmland and promote sound stewardship. And I would guess most of your listeners might not necessarily think of the estate tax as being one of the first issues that we'd think about in that context. But in fact, the way the estate tax plays out right now is when an estate passes to the next generation, it is in fact taxed on the potential value of that land in whatever economic use that it might be put into, the highest potential economic use, as opposed to the actual use, which in the case of farms quite often is a lot lower value or it doesn't generate as much economic return as some of the alternative uses. So we see that as a real powerful incentive that we have put in place artificially that causes a lot of people to have to sell their farmland when it's passing from one generation to the next. And so that really leads us to say, let's take a close look at that and figure out how we remove that artificial incentive to convert agricultural land that we clearly need, with a greater emphasis on the number of people we need to feed, the environmental services coming from that land, make sure that we keep that land in an agricultural use instead of forcing it to be converted.
Do you have ideas about how that can happen?
Well, really, what we've been trying to do in our discussions on Capitol Hill is to focus on the land. And not be quite as concerned about who's holding the land or how long have people been engaged in an agricultural operation on that land, and to say, if you will in fact keep farmland in agriculture, then we want to, ideally would like to see the estate tax eliminated, but certainly reduce the amount of cost that the family is going to incur when they make that transition from one generation to the next.
Are you making those words available on deaf ears?
Well, I wouldn't say deaf ears. No, not at all. In fact, I think that it appeared as though there was an effort, particularly on the Senate side, that was about ready to go here a month or so ago, that didn't necessarily take that point of view. And I believe we have successfully gotten across the point that we really need to look at this issue, and I have no doubt there are others that are in consideration as well. But we feel pretty good about the feedback we're getting, particularly from the staff that's working on this issue on Capitol Hill right now, that they are kind of pausing, stepping back, taking a look at this particular aspect of the concerns we've raised, and hopefully they'll be addressed here as we see this issue continue to play out through the remainder of the year.
Let's switch topics just a bit. A recent press release from the American Farmland Trust pointed to a lack of vegetable and fruit acres in the United States, something along the lines, according to your organization, of needing about 13 million more acres just to meet the daily USDA requirements set out in that food triangle, pyramid, that is. Can you tell me more about what it is that the American Farmland Trust would like to happen?
Well, this is another area, kind of going back to my earlier point, of the many ways that we try to approach farmland preservation and promoting sound stewardship. You know, one of the things that you haven't mentioned that's interesting about that statistic is an awful lot of the land that's producing kind of direct consumption commodities, fruits and vegetables, really is the land that's most clearly in the path of development. In fact, we've found that 86% of U.S. fruits and vegetables and 63% of dairy products are produced on prime farmland in urban-influenced areas. So we feel that while there's clearly a lot of reasons to be supportive of getting more fruits and vegetables in people's diets, there's also an important consideration to understand that if you're going to have that kind of locally grown produce, you have to have the farmland. And, you know, one of our bumper stickers that's very popular that we use is no farms, no food. If we can't help protect those areas, particularly now where a lot of those kinds of products are being generated, are being grown, then we're not going to have the kind of locally accessible food supplies, the fresh fruits and vegetables that people are increasingly demanding.
Is this a food insecurity tack that you're taking with Washington, D.C.?
Well, certainly that's an important part of it. You know, people, I think, are maybe a little more keenly in tune to the security of their food supply and where it's coming from in a world that's getting more and more globalized. So that's one of the arguments, one of the points we try to make. You know, there's clearly also a lot of attention being focused on the health of what people are eating. And, you know, as we've done, I think, on the farms and my farm family, certainly for my entire life, understanding the nutritional value of those kinds of products and the important part of the diets that people have on a daily basis is another important twist on this. So there's a lot of reasons to be supporting it, a lot of reasons to be concerned, and clearly the American Farmland Trust is engaged in that and seeking to address that issue as we look ahead to you know, farm bill debates and other opportunities we have along the way.
How do you relate it to urban sprawl?
Well, I think urban sprawl is related from the standpoint that if people want that kind of local produce, you know, clearly you've got to have the resources available to be able to provide that. And when you allow urban sprawl to take place and you have the corresponding impact of finding it very difficult to maintain that kind of infrastructure that you need to have to support a viable farming operation, then you're really pushing that farther and farther out. Quite often it's the best farmland that's being taken when that sprawl is taking place. So you have more vulnerable land that's more, you know, inclined to be erosive or not have the kind of soil types to get the level of productivity you want, soils that may need more fertility or whatever. Those are the kinds of impacts that I think you start to see as urban sprawl takes place. There are impacts that I think more people are becoming concerned about, and clearly things we seek to emphasize as we try to relate to people in those towns and cities as to why they should be concerned about making sure we maintain that productive agricultural base in this country.
Yeah, so you look at maintaining the productive agricultural base and possibly holding back urban sprawl, but that probably means that city centers would need to be reinvented to some respect. That maybe they need to grow up instead of out. How do you deal with city councils and county boards on this idea to really sell them on the idea that farmland doesn't necessarily need to be converted into a property tax base?
Well, it's certainly a challenge, and you know, we've had 30 years in this organization of seeking to address that challenge, and I have no doubt we're going to be very busy in the next 30 years continuing to try to make those points. But I guess I would say, I think in a lot of ways, that argument's getting a little easier to make because we do hear so much about our food supply. And, you know, the First Lady has her program focused on nutritional diets, especially for children. And a lot of that comes back to, you know, fruits and vegetables, the kind of production that seems to be especially vulnerable in the path of urban development. And so I think there's an opportunity for the agricultural community to, you know, have arguments that resonate in ways that certainly help to serve the ends that the agricultural community feel are important in ways that we didn't even see 5 to 10 years ago. One of the studies, for instance, that we've been engaged in, one of the signature items that we've done here with the American Farmland Trust was a food shed study that we did around the area of San Francisco, California, clearly an area where, you know, folks are increasingly concerned about where's their food coming from and is it local and all that kind of stuff. And we looked at the question of, you know, can that metropolitan area feed itself within 100 miles? Now, of course, they could because they've got a little bit of a unique climate there. But I think the point is it brought together the mayor of the city of San Francisco, agricultural leaders, leaders from a number of groups interested in food, interested in the social fabric of that metropolitan area, in a discussion and focused on issues relating from food accessibility to land use to a whole host of other things that I would argue is very unique and I think a good example of how we have opportunities to bring people together in ways that can address important public concerns, but also to do it in a way that can help develop or continue a thriving agricultural base.
Are you familiar, for instance, with Walmart's move to limit the number of transportation miles that they might be trucking products and in the process redevelop orchards and vegetable crop farms closer to the Midwest than they have been?
Yes, I certainly am, and I have staff that's been involved in that effort with them. And I think that's one of the things that's also helping to drive this. Clearly, you know, there's been a lot being written, a lot being spoken on radio programs like yours about where our food's coming from. But also, I think you're finding a lot of very large retailers really start to weigh in on this. And that's, in fact, becoming one of the big drivers of attention or change being brought about to address these kinds of issues. And clearly Walmart, with all the good points and all the bad points that their involvement can bring, is one of the leaders in that area and certainly helping to tee this up in a way that's, I think, going to help to bring about some change.
What other issues are you taking up there in the American Farmland Trust in terms of legislation at this point?
Well, everybody's talking about the Farm Bill. Or at least within the Beltway they are, and I think this is even getting more prevalent outside when you talk to commodity group leaders and even talk to farmers. I think they understand that Chairman Peterson in particular, Chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, is doing a round of hearings across the country. I think everybody's painfully aware of the budget challenges, the budget problems we've got in the federal government and really governments across the country. And they understand that, you know, farm programs, we're going to have to redouble efforts and work very hard to make sure that they're focused on, you know, programs and providing services that not only help agriculture, but also can get public support. And we're certainly doing what we need to do to gear up to continue to play, hopefully, a viable and important role in farm policy debate on a whole host of issues, from conservation to farmland preservation to renewable energy to, you know, really, how do you provide a public investment in agriculture in a way that helps farmers but doesn't distort markets and have some corresponding environmental problems that we need to address?
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Our guest today on the phone line from Washington, D.C. is John Shaw, the president of the American Farmland Trust. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, heavy machinery manufacturer Caterpillar says its second quarter earnings shot up 91%. on a big increase in sales of equipment for industries like mining, infrastructure, and energy. Caterpillar had net income of $707 million, or $1.09 per share. That was up from $371 million, or 60 cents per share of profit a year ago. Sales rose 31% to $10.4 billion, with Caterpillar reporting gains in machinery sales in all four global regions it serves. U.S. lawmakers yesterday called for tough new measures to punish China for its failure to stop widespread piracy and counterfeiting of U.S. goods, ranging from music CDs to manufactured products. Lawmakers repeatedly pressed President Barack Obama's chief intellectual property enforcement official to tell them what greater pressure the U.S. could bring on China. The International Intellectual Property Alliance, which represents U.S. copyright industry groups, has estimated lost sales in China at more than $3.5 billion in 2009 due to piracy. And for the first time, an American automaker plans to sell a hybrid car for the same price as its gas-powered counterpart. Ford says it will debut the Lincoln MKZ hybrid this fall. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest today, John Scholl of the American Farmland Trust. Mr. Scholl, when we last talked, you had just discussed some of the legislation that's coming up, the 2012 Farm Bill. Have you been listening with great interest to what Chairman Peterson has been saying and hearing as he goes out into the nation and talks to producers? And what kinds of ideas might the American Farmland Trust have for the next set of farm programs?
Well, certainly have been listening with great interest. I certainly admire Chairman Peterson and the leadership that he's providing on this issue. I think it is important that we get out and get an early start, that we do the listening, which is going to be a very important part of this whole process, to make sure as we head into what I'm sure is going to be a very contentious and difficult debate, once again, that we have the good ideas on the table, that we've thoroughly vetted things. And I think the chairman deserves a lot of credit for getting out early and moving as aggressively as he is. There are several things that I think in terms of what we're hearing that is important to us. One of the things clearly is a focus on a revenue base for farm support programs. You may or may not know that the American Farmland Trust was one of the principal leaders in developing the ACRE program in the last round. Worked very closely with the National Corn Growers to promote a concept which, again, listening to your program, I know has been a hot topic and I think gaining momentum. And clearly, as the chairman has spoken and he's had these hearings, I think some sort of revenue-based approach is something that a lot of people are taking a hard look at. The other thing that I would focus on in a general sense is the environmental and conservation programs. And I think you're hearing even more about that right now because of the oil spill. In fact, a person told me just this morning, I haven't seen this myself, but there's apparently signs around town that say beaches have never closed because of an ethanol spill. And I think, you know, what agriculture can do to help contribute to energy security, to help contribute to environmental security, is going to be an increasingly important part of the next Farm Bill discussion, as it has been for the last couple of rounds of farm policy debate.
On conservation of farmland, and in particular the conservation activities of producers, do you think that it would be wise in this Farm Bill to discuss the ideas of paying producers more on what they do on the farm rather than the kinds of products that they're producing, so that if they have buffer zones, if they have waterways, if they're no-till or low-till, that they might reap some kind of investment into their farm from the federal government as opposed to direct payments?
I think it's not only wise, it's critical. I think part of the drivers that we're seeing in this whole Farm Bill debate that we're leading up to here is an increased concern about you know, why are we paying farmers to do what we're paying them to do? And a lot of that goes to, you know, supporting specific commodities. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that agriculture is a huge part of the solution to a lot of environmental challenges this country faces. And, you know, trying to help farmers be able to have the expertise and the resources necessary to capture that opportunity and fulfill that need is critically important, and that certainly is part of this farm bill debate. I also think it's important because I think we're making progress in the public understanding that agriculture is an important part of that solution. And while they're getting increasingly concerned about, you know, farm program commodity payments that's been building here over the last number of decades, I think they're also much more willing to listen to what is it you can do on the farm that we can help you do that can address some real top-of-mind issues that we continue to hear about. And so I think it's not only a necessity, it's an opportunity we have in this next Farm Bill policy discussion to say, you know, how in addition to making farmers the best corn and soybean producers, for instance, can we do, but also how can we help them be the best producers of environmental benefits that I think agriculture is uniquely positioned to provide, and that clearly the public can be very supportive of and, in fact, wanting very much.
Okay, one last topic, and it'll be a different one. We'll go back to locally sourced food just a bit. Can I take you to Detroit, where there's been a mass population dispersal from the center town center, which sets on the lake, to about 8 miles out? Almost everybody is gone, apparently. And so there are these large tracts of property and land that have abandoned homes and neighborhoods there. And there's some talk within Detroit that they might want to convert some of that into farmland or into gardens. What kinds of things do you think are possible and should be done in that sort of situation?
Well, when I look at that, you know, first of all, I understand that we're not going to probably ever get to a point where you're totally going to feed the city of Detroit with production in those areas. Clearly, all of agriculture is needed to feed the growing demand for food that we continue to see. But I also think very quickly about a point that, you know, I've heard farmers talk about around board tables of organizations for years, and that's concern about the lost connection that seems to be taking place between consumers and the producers of our food. And I'm personally of the belief that anything we can do to engage more people in, you know, be it gardening, you know, agriculture on a small scale, whatever the case might be, we're going to do more to help people understand what it really takes and the challenges that we have of producing food that, you know, I think farmers are keenly aware of, but too many other people aren't. So I look at that and say, what a terrific opportunity to help communicate, you know, some very basic tenets of, you know, agriculture, farming, and what it takes to put food on the table, that opportunities like that present to us, even involved in mainstream agriculture.
Mr. Shull, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I was pleased to have the opportunity.
John Shull is the president of the American Farmland Trust. You can visit their website at www.farmland.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farm.